This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Congressman Dan Kildee is in his second term in the U.S. House. The Democrat represents Michigan's 5th District, which includes Flint, Saginaw, and Bay City. We are speaking on Monday as Congressman Kildee visits the west side of Michigan, Kalamazoo and Grand Rapids, to discuss, among other things, protecting the Great Lakes. Congressman Dan Kildee, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
You've been very outspoken in your opposition to a proposed permanent nuclear waste facility in Ontario, Canada, which would be just across from Port Huron,
right,
over on the other side of the lake. What are the risks to the entire state of Michigan and the Midwest, as you see them, of a nuclear waste repository in Canada?
Well, I think it's important to acknowledge that the risk of an accident or release are low, but not inconsequential. And so because of that, we have to think about what would be the consequence of a release. And the fact that this proposed facility is 6/10 of a mile under Lake Huron, to me, it sort of begs the question as to whether or not this is the most ideal location. Now, they, you know, scientists that they have hired have pled that the geology and the rock formation there is sufficient to protect from any release. But we've heard these things before, and, you know, human error does cause mistakes to be made. The mistake associated with a release at this facility is a much different question than a mistake that might be made, such as the one that took place in New Mexico just a few months ago, where it was easy to contain. If we got any sort of nuclear material into the world's greatest freshwater source, the Great Lakes system, the ability to contain that would be very, very limited. And so to me, it just begs the question, is there another facility? Is there another location? The fact that the Canadian government never even looked at another location is of some concern to me, and we're just asking that they do that.
Now, the Canadian government's going to make the final call on this, correct?
They will. They will. The Ministry of the Environment will receive a report on May 6 from the what's something called the Joint Review Panel, which is the entity that Ontario Power Generation has used to receive public input, and they have received a lot of public input from both sides of the border and from virtually everybody across the ideological spectrum. I have a resolution that I've introduced into Congress that would express a sense of Congress, because we don't have the right to legislate for the Canadians, but that would express our sense that the U.S. and Canadian governments should work together to locate a more suitable facility. And that resolution has bipartisan support. I've got 10 Democrats and 9 Republicans that have signed on just in the last couple of weeks. We expect many more. The reason I mention that is that this shouldn't be perceived as an ideological or partisan question. It's not even a referendum on the question of nuclear energy in the first place, nor is it a U.S. versus Canada question, because there are many Canadians who are equally concerned about this and have raised the issue. I've been working with a member of Parliament, Brian Massey, from the Windsor area on this issue, and he's very concerned as well. This is simply about our environmental stewardship, our need to protect the Great Lakes, not just for ourselves, but for a generation 100 or 200 or 300 years from now. And I think it's when we look at it through that lens, it's a much simpler question.
Let me go back, though, to something you were mentioning earlier, which is there a better place for this? As you know, if you hop in the car here from Kalamazoo and drive about 45 minutes, you get very close to the Palisades Nuclear Power Plant,
right,
where there is nuclear waste stored in these dry casks,
right,
right along the Lake Michigan shoreline. I guess I'm getting to a broader question of, ultimately, what do we do with nuclear waste?
Well, and this is where the United States has its own responsibility. First of all, the temporary storage on site is not appropriate either. So in both Canada and the U.S., we've been committed to find permanent facilities that prevent, you know, any potential hazard. In the United States, Yucca Mountain is the facility that has long been debated and still not finalized as the permanent nuclear waste storage facility because of its unique characteristics. And one, of course, unique characteristic is that there is no proximity to any water source. Any potential hazard that could occur would be much more easily managed. But I think you raise a good point. Our objection here is because this would be a permanent facility. We know we need to deal with these temporary facilities as well. The United States has taken some steps to do it. Canadians are working on it. But I think we need to be very smart about how we manage this.
Should we debate Yucca Mountain again? Is it time to get that facility open and ship nuclear waste there?
I mean, I think so. It's been held up primarily because Senator Reid has objected to it.
And it's his home state.
And of course, he's retiring. And so who knows if that will change the dynamic. But it does beg the question, and this is where we do get into the issue of nuclear power. It would seem to me a necessary prerequisite to nuclear power systems, nuclear energy, that we have some way of managing the waste that comes from those systems. I think what was planned, or it is planned at Yucca Mountain, meets the test. And the simple test that I apply says that Kincardine, Ontario, directly across from us, 0.6 of a mile from the world's greatest freshwater source, does not meet that test.
Now, I've been covering the nuclear issue here in Kalamazoo for many years, and what the opponents have said to me over and over again is Yucca Mountain may be fine once you get the nuclear waste there, but you got to get it there. And there's always concerns about how can you securely move it from, say, South Haven, Michigan,
sure,
or Bridgman, Michigan, where its D.C. Cook nuclear power plant is, and make sure it's going to get to Yucca Mountain safely without incident along the way. Do you have concerns about that as well?
I do. And this is where, you know, the details matter. The one thing I will say is that while we need to make sure that we have a permanent facility for storage that anticipates 5,000-10,000 years down the road, our obligations to that population, that long in the future population, the details matter. Moving this material is hazardous unto itself. But one thing I know for sure is that keeping this material stored on the shores of our Great Lakes is the worst place for it. And so we have to do it right. We have to be careful about it. And we have to make sure we're guided by all the latest technology and science. But we can't just leave this stuff laying around next to the lakes. That's just too great of a hazard for us.
While you're here, I also want to ask you about a gentleman from your district, Amir Hekmati, who is being held in Iran. You have been calling for his release. At the same time, you have said that you do want the Obama administration to move forward with negotiating some sort of a deal with Iran to limit their nuclear capability. How big a bargaining chip, though, is this for the United States, or how big a concern is it when they're trying to work out a deal with Iran? It's not just Amir Hekmati. There's a number of other American citizens being held. How hard should the U.S. press?
Well, the U.S. should press very hard. And the difficulty here, and this is a really significant conundrum, we don't ever want to put ourselves in a position that the freedom of innocent Americans could be exchanged for what would presumably be concessions at the nuclear negotiation. So to connect the two directly implies that the negotiation would have us involved in a give and take. And I just don't accept the notion that the freedom of innocent Americans, people who have been grabbed for political purposes, should be exchanged for something that we would give at the negotiating table. So I frame it in this way. In order for Iran to be accepted as a member, a legitimate member of the global community, which means in order for any agreement that Iran enters into to be looked at as a legitimate document, they can't hold political prisoners. So the pressure has been on them. And our government, I think, has appropriately pushed. I've talked to the president many, many times about Amir. I've talked to Secretary Kerry and our chief negotiator about this. They push his case and the case of Jason Rezaian, the Washington Post reporter, Saeed Abedini, who is a Christian minister who's over there. And then the case of Mr. Levinson, who's been gone for about 7 years, there's not real certainty about where he is. We push these cases all the time in a way that makes it clear to Iran that if at the end of the day there is an agreement that they negotiate that is acceptable, we can't escape that we have to view it through the context of their other behaviors. And keeping political prisoners who are simply innocent people who are charged in the case of Amir Hekmati with cooperating with a hostile government because he was born in the United States and served in the Marine Corps, I mean, that's just too much for us to take.
Does it raise questions about Iran's credibility as we move forward with an agreement? I mean, of course, there's supposed to be ways to verify all of this. But at the end of the day, does this raise some questions about trust? And can we really move forward and have an agreement with a country where Americans are held as political prisoners?
Right. I think it raises that question for sure. And the way I view this agreement is that it cannot be based on trust. It has to be based on a regime of inspection that allows us to know in real time everything that they're doing regarding their nuclear capabilities. And so that's really a sticking point right now on the negotiations. What kind of access would we have, would the international community have, the IAEA have, and how would we be able to know if they were moving toward weaponizing nuclear material? In other words, what is the length of time, the so-called breakout period that they would have? These negotiations are not about trust. They're not about Iran in terms of, you know, the veracity of the Iranians themselves. It's about what the structure of the agreement does. And it's not like there's a better Iran that we can go negotiate with. They are a threat to global stability. And we should do everything we can to prevent them from acquiring a nuclear weapon. Walking away from the negotiating table, to me, is a fast track to them getting a nuclear weapon, because they will see that as their only alternative to continue to force their might and their will. So some of my colleagues who have said we should walk away, we should negotiate with them, really need to think through what the long-term implications of that decision might be. I mean, it's easy to pat yourself on the back and say how tough you are and criticize Iran and we won't negotiate with them. That doesn't make the world safer.
Do these two things then almost have to be looked at as entirely separate issues, the nuclear negotiations and political prisoners, that they're box A and B, and, right, and they can't be conjoined in any way?
They can't be conjoined. The interesting thing is the fact of the nuclear negotiations means that for the first time in 35 years, there's discussion directly between senior Iranian officials and senior U.S. officials, which provides the space for offline sidebar discussions regarding Amir and the other Americans that are being held. So it's distinct on one hand, but on the other hand, the fact that these negotiations are underway has given us the chance to have a conversation about the Americans.
All right. Let me, before we wrap up here, talk a little about politics. We're only a few months, it seems, removed from the 2014 election.
Right.
We're talking about 2016. Over the weekend, there were some bigger hints that Governor Rick Snyder may get in to the race for the Republican nomination for president, although he's saying it's still speculation. If Rick Snyder were somehow involved in the presidential race at some point on the ticket, either spot one or spot two, does that in any way change the dynamic for Michigan, which has been a reliable Democratic state now for the past several presidential elections?
I mean, I think it's possible, although, you know, frankly, and, you know, this probably won't surprise you to hear me say this, I think Governor Snyder's record is not one that I think would even warrant his own reelection as governor if he could run for a third term. I think there are some serious questions about his leadership. Very often what happens is the national narrative around one of the sort of political leaders from a state is not always consistent with the way their own state views them. Tip O'Neill said all politics are local, and I think it would be tough. Now, I will say this, anything that raises Michigan's profile in the national conversation is a good thing. And so while I think Governor Snyder's chances would be pretty slim, I mean, becoming the 20th candidate in the Republican side is a bit of a roll of the dice. I think his chances would be slim. I do think the focus on Michigan wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing. I mean, we don't get the kind of attention, partly because we haven't been that competitive since 1988. We really haven't had a competitive race for president here. So we don't get the kind of attention that we would like to have. And the more attention you get in a presidential campaign, the more attention you're likely to get once whoever is elected takes office.
I think I would point out that 2000 and 2004 were relatively close. The Democrats won them, but
they looked like they were going to be a lot closer than they were. I remember, yeah, in 2000, we had Vice President Gore here right up to the very end. And in fact, he spent more time here than he did the last day of the campaign. He went straight to Florida, didn't get there till after midnight. As it turned out, our margin was a lot stronger. And in Florida, some of us think he actually won Florida. He might have been better off spending a couple more days there. It was a close race across the country, but in our case, you know, it turned out to be more solid than we expected.
Congressman Dan Kildee, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
That interview with Congressman Dan Kildee was recorded on Monday. The Democrat from Flint had events that day in both Kalamazoo and Grand Rapids. Today it was announced that Kildee is introducing a bipartisan resolution calling for the release of Amir Hekmati and other Americans held in Iran. According to a news release, the resolution is co-sponsored by members of Congress who represent families of Americans who are missing or being held in Iran. It expresses the sense of the Congress that those American citizens should be released. Links with more information and longer versions of interviews on West Southwest can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.